Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. How's it going? All right. My name's Ken Clark. I'm the director of the Poetry Center. And this is an organization that was established 30 years ago by a group of Chicago poets, some of whom are here tonight. The Poetry Center has presented through its annual reading series hundreds of the world's poets. This reading by Campbell McGrath is one of several events of this year's 31st annual reading series. Next year, which is the spring season, part of this season, we're featuring Mark Strand, Lucille Clifton, and several other poets. You'll get a brochure in the mail soon. In addition to the reading series, we sponsor a program called Hands on Stanzas, where Chicago poets go into public schools in Chicago, teach students how to read and write poetry with the hopes that their literacy and their creative literacy will be enhanced. This year, 3,000 students will be directly impacted by this program, and about 13,000 indirectly through school-wide projects. These are 20-week, year-long residencies, so they really have an impact on the students of Chicago. I'd like to thank and recognize the board of directors of the Poetry Center and also the staff and volunteers. The back table is all volunteers. Thank you. Thank you very much for selling books and all that kind of stuff. The Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. We've been here for 20 years. Support comes from the Lannan Foundation, Target Stores, Poetry Center members, the Illinois Arts Council, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Chicago Community Trust, the MacArthur Fund for Arts and Culture at the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation, the Verizon Foundation, Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Boeing Company, Allen and Lynn Turner, LaSalle Bank, Bank One, the Fund for Poetry, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, and the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation. It's a big list. We work hard to secure those, and we are very thankful for their support. Julian Cohen will introduce this evening's poet. Julian is a board member of the Poetry Center of Chicago and recently won second place at the University of Chicago's Alumni Poetry Contest, judged by Mark Strand. In his spare time, he is vice president at DDB Chicago, one of the world's largest advertising firms. Julian?
Thank you, Ken. Usually I give presentations and I have PowerPoint behind me, so I feel a little naked up here right now. Okay, I like poetry a lot. This is entirely the fault of Campbell McGrath. The year is 1991. I'm a naive and marginally enthusiastic economics student at the University of Chicago, about to graduate and go work in the world of advertising. A fraternity brother of mine convinces me to submit my ramblings for a poetry class being offered in the spring. Some guy named Campbell McGrath is teaching. So while everyone else types their earnest and caressed poems, I scrawl a series of 2- and 3-line pieces, I learned later that these are called epigrams, on a piece of yellow legal paper and submit the lot to Campbell for admission into his class. Somehow, perhaps mistakenly, he accepts me into the class. Looking back, I think it was because of my penmanship. And that's the story of how I ended up in Campbell McGrath's very first poetry class. Now, more important and hopefully more interesting than this little story is what I got out of this one class now over a decade ago. Yeah, over a decade ago. For lack of a better word, I'll call this passion. First off, I got this passion for writing. Bitten by the poetry bug, I kept writing and eventually got myself one of those MFAs. And now, why on earth did an econ major, frat boy, future ad exec think he could write poetry? Well, the simplistic answer is this: because Campbell made it okay for 7-Elevens to be the subject of a poem. His effortless portrayal of the latter 20th century American terrain in which most of us post-boomers grew up made poetry salient. All of a sudden, I could eschew Grecian urns for my unnatural love of Johnny Quest. But underlying this passion for writing, a passion which, as we all know, comes and goes depending on one's relationship with the muse, is the passion for language, a passion for words, the way they sound, what they mean, and what you can do with them. Campbell McGrath has a passion for language, a passion that is contagious. He just plain enjoys language. Words are fun to play with, to bend, to stretch, push to the limit. To quote a couple of reviewers completely out of context, but who are clearly more articulate critics than myself, This legitimizes all this by quoting other people. McGrath has developed a signature style that is brutally expansive, slangy, and rife with high and low tone jargon. His Promethean eruptions are at once explosive, swaggering, opportunistic, and flip, a brilliant bubbling forth of a comic and serious intelligence. McGrath's lines zing like pinballs in a machine about to tilt. His poetry is part fable, part diatribe, part elegy, part love song. McGrath's poetry combines the lyricism and lines of Whitman with 500 channels of cable television. Suffice it to say, Campbell's word palette is as bold, expansive, and embracing as the American culture he uses as his canvas. So that's what I got out of that one class all that those years ago. And now for the real stuff of introductions. Campbell McGrath is the author of five collections of poetry: Capitalism, American Noise, Spring Comes to Chicago, Road Atlas, and Florida Poems. He has won the Kingsley Tufts Prize, the Cohen Prize, no relation, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Winter-Binner Fellowship from the Library of Congress in association with the Poet Laureate, and a MacArthur Genius Grant. He teaches creative writing at Florida International University and lives in Miami Beach with his wife and two sons. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors and distant relatives of the Poetry Center, please join me in welcoming Campbell McGrath.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Julian. I remember letting Julian in that class. I really do. And it was just the right thing to do. You know, I mean, you know, advertising has learned everything it knows from poetry anyway, as we all know. They stole every trick in the poetry handbag from day one. And so it was, you know, it was a natural. I was really just actually doing him a kind of a corporate favor. It's delightful, actually, to be back in Chicago, where I myself was a student and learned to write poetry and want to write poetry, and to come back here kind of serially, as I now do, to teach, as I did when I taught Julian 10 years ago, and a bunch of my students from last year at the university are here as well. So it's really nice to be back here, a place that I was born and have often returned to. Some people are serial murderers. I'm a serial Chicagoan. I want to read about 13 poems tonight, 13, 14, 12, about 40 minutes probably. And I want to thank everybody again. I didn't really do a very good job. Julian kind of threw me off with his bringing me back to that moment in 1991. Thanks to the Poetry Center so much for having me out here. It's a great organization, the amount of work. I taught a workshop last night for them, with just a terrific, dedicated bunch of students. And it's a real tribute to Chicago that the city supports such a variety of arts and literary organizations, a texture of them. It's something that the entire state of Florida, you know, would desperately wish to show any kind of portion of. And here in Chicago, you really have an amazing richness of them. And it's on account of people that just put the work in. Let me just start us off in Chicago, and then we'll kind of travel elsewhere and end up back in Chicago at the end. And this poem's called Wild Thing. I will be forever 19, driving a white Impala convertible down the Pacific Coast Highway while the radio plays nothing but my favorite songs. I will live among the wild men of Borneo, drink boar's blood, watch the slow dance of planets through my bamboo telescope. I will alter the consciousness of the free world, shake the philosophical foundations of Western civilization while dating Vanna White. I will rock the Roxy and the Ritz, ride the rails, roam center field for the Cubs. I will rise and shine. I will reign. I will rule. Believe me. Alas, life is poor preparation for death. All those years of practice for the grand event that never happens. No flute recital before the masses. No squash game with God. In such matters, our short-sightedness is fundamental. History is a wave, and we surf it beautifully, carving the face, shredding the curl of that perfectly marbled breaker spiced with essential stoke, or so we imagine. But before this wave came others, and beyond it lies a veritable ocean of rills and wavelets and mighty tsunamis we've failed to notice, our eyes so full of spray, blinded by the tingling sensations of the moment, as if time were a force field or energized aura, a second skin like gravity or desire, that by its very nature constricts our vision, contains us as a pig's intestine stuffed with pork and anise by some overwrought Italian butcher. How else could Elizabeth continue to wear those shoes, those black buckled high tops, combat boots for elves, which will so clearly seem an utter embarrassment in the photo album 20 years from now? My God, look what I wore in the 90s. How else to explain the statue of Ceres atop the Board of Trade, elegantly appropriate but left without a face, unfinished, because they didn't think the city would grow tall enough to notice? And don't we all recognize that blank expression? Don't we each cherish our unique and individual nature, every paper cut or broken heart the first, the most severe, each vow or resolution the mark of some brave new beginning? No two snowflakes are exactly alike, but every fucking snowflake is pretty much the same. Every life a variation on a theme of suffering and meaninglessness, full of distractions, frisbees, beautiful trees, girls in orange sandals. In fact, the distractions are the main event. There is no grace period, no warm-up tosses or pre-season schedule. The game has not only begun, it's the top of the sixth inning and you still haven't scored. A shutout. The world has pitched a shutout against your life. For all your slick manipulations of that magic bat, you're deep in the hole that counts against you. Your net result is a fat string of goose eggs hung like loops of fresh kielbasa from the rafters. And time is running out. We're into the seventh. Now it's the eighth and the lights are coming on. The fans are clapping with nervous anticipation. Look, out in the bullpen, he's warming up. The main man, the big guy, the stopper, the ace. But what about those dreams, your hopes for the future? To plumb the depths of the Marianas Trench in a gilded bathysphere, to write the epic masterwork of greed and heroism and love, to build a house with your own two hands in the hills outside of Santa Fe and raise up chickens and dogs and a family there, the jet ski, the guitar lessons, the macrame. Hey, I'd better get serious, get something going before it's too late. It is too late. Bottom of the ninth, two gone. They've given the signal and he's entering the game. He's coming in to face you. He's making his way slowly across the grass. The inexorable closer is coming. Believe me, it isn't Mitch Williams.
Yeah, I guess you have to be a Cubs fan to really recognize that. It's strange. I really have always liked about that poem, pinning the entire poem to an obscure, meaningless reference to Mitch Williams in the last line. Which is a kind of quixotic gesture, I suppose. But it was such a powerful image, the notion of the erratic closer. Another Chicago poem, The Golden Angel Pancake House. This is from my book, Spring Comes to Chicago. The Golden Angel Pancake House. Or coming out of Bento on a wild midwinter midnight, or later, closing time, Ron says, the last rack of pool balls ratcheted down until dawn. Bottles corked and watered, lights out, going out the door beneath the L tracks over Clark and Sheffield. Always a train showing up just then, loud, sure as hell, showering sparks upon the snowfall, shaking slightly the lights and trestles. Us in our fellowship shouting and scurrying like the more sprightly selves we once inhabited, behind parked cars and street signs thinking, hey, should we toss some snowballs? Bullseye, the beauty of fresh snow in the hands, like rubbing tree bark to catch that contact high direct from the inexplicable source. Unique, however often repeated, carried along on woolen thumbs to the next absolutely necessary thing, slow gin fizzes to green mill jazz or the horror of Jägermeister at the Ginger Man or one of those German bars up around Irving Park where a sup of the Weiss beer on tap is enough to convince me to forswear my stake in any vision of the afterlife you might care to construct. Say the one with the photo of the owner in his Nazi uniform beside a pristine fjord could be Norway, 1940? Whichever, we're hungry now, cast out into the false dawn of snow-coiffed streetlights embowed like bowl-cut adolescents or Roman emperors sated on frost,
thumbs up or down to hash and eggs at Manny's or the locally infamous Alps. Then there's one at which I never ate, though it looked absolutely irreplaceable, the Golden Angel Pancake House, which is a poem by Rilke I've never read, though I've used its restroom, seen its dim celestial figures like alien life forms in a goldfish bowl, tasted its lonely nectar in every stack of silver dollar buttermilk flapjacks, though the food, for all I know, is unutterably awful. The way it resonates is what carries me down the swirled cords of memory toward the bottom of the frosted glass aquarium of dreams, whatever that means. It's what it meant to me coming home those nights from the Lutheran College after teaching the Duino elegies to the daughters and sons of Minnesota farmers. The footbridge over the north branch of the Chicago River, frozen solid, eddies of whirling ionized powder around my boots in the bone-cold sub-zero that makes the lights in the windows of houses so painfully beautiful. Is it the longing to get the hell inside, or the tears the wind inevitably summons forth? Homeward, all the way down Lincoln Avenue's amazing arabesques and ethnic configurations of Korean babushkas and Croatian karaoke, that feeling set upon me like the overture to God knows what dread disease, that cathartic, lustral, yes, idiot laughter, thread of tears in the gullet, Adam's apple stringing its yo-yo to follow the bouncing ball, as if boulevards of such purity could countenance no science but eudaimonics. Hardly likely, as if this Promethean eruption were merely one of the more colorful dog and pony acts of simple happiness, acrobatic dromedaries or narcoleptic dancing bears, but which I have come to see with perfect hindsight was no less than the mighty strongman Joy himself bending bars of steel upon a tattooed skull, so much nobler and more rapacious than his country cousins, bliss, elation, glee, a troop of toothless, dipsomaniacal clowns, multiform and variable as flurries from blizzards, while Joy is singular, present tense, predatory, priapic, paradoxically composed of sorrow and terror as ice is made of water, dense and pure, darkly bejeweled, music rather than poetry, preliterate, lapidary, dumb as an ox, cruel as youth, magnificent and remorseless as Chicago in winter. Not quite winter, though, is it? It was it's welcome when one's lived 11 years in Miami to get cold, gray, damp weather, but I know that that's not that's of no help to you here in Chicago. But for me, it was actually quite delightful the last 2 days. Nonetheless, we will eventually get to spring in Chicago, literally, that is. I do want to turn to Florida now. Having moved from Chicago to Florida 12 years ago, and still trying to make even vague sense of the place, I'm going to read 5 or 6 poems about Florida from my last book, Florida Poems. This book's called The Orange. This poem's called The Orange, I should say. Gone to swim after walking the boys to school. Overcast morning, midweek, off-season. Few souls to brave the warm, storm-tossed waves. Not wild, but rough for this tranquil coast. Swimming now, in rhythm, arm over arm. Let the ocean buoy the body and the legs work little. Wave overhead, crash and roll with it. Breathe, stretch and build, windmill, climb the foam. Breathe, breathe. Traveling downwind, I make good time and spot the marker by which I know to halt and forge my way ashore. Who am I to question the current? Surely this is peace abiding. Walking back along the beach, I mark the signs of erosion, bide the usual flotsam of seagrass and fan coral, afloat from somebody's fishing boat, crusted with sponge and barnacles, and then I find the orange. Single irradiant sphere on the sand, tide-washed, glistening as if newborn, golden orb, miraculous fruit, in all that sweep of horizon, the only point of color. Cross-legged on my towel, I let the juice course and mingle with the film of salt on my lips and the sand in my beard as I steadily peel and eat it. Considering the ancient lineage of this fruit, the long history of its dispersal around the globe on currents of animal and human migration, and in light of the importance of the citrus industry to the state of Florida, I will not claim it was the best and sweetest orange in the world, though it was, O great salt water of eternity, O strange and bountiful orchard. A very small poem, The Key Lime. Curiously yellow hand grenade of flavor, Molotov cocktail for a revolution against the bland. The manatee. Deep sunk in the dream time of his terminal coma, the manatee persists like a vegetative outpatient, victim of the whirling propellers of impatience and a buoyantly bovine quiescence gone nova. Dream deep, brother. Dream long and deep, sister sea cow. May millennia of soft tides and seagrass sustain thy sleep across the dark ages of extinction. May your memory keep heavy the hearts and hulls of your inheritors, us, for now. Trouble with Miami. Trouble with Miami is the lack of significant galleries and serious theater, the absence of museums, operas, ballets, symphonies, a dearth of cultural infrastructure so profound that the only local institution worth its salt is the ocean, that watching the beautiful women on the beach with bodies cast from bronze and soft-lobed chrome may be our best shot at real enlightenment. Their formal aspects comprise our artistic endowment. Their lubricity constitutes our aesthetic nourishment. Hard candy, loaves, and fishes. A sculpture garden of erotic possibility displayed in postures of wicked amusement, like wild palms abandoned to wind and solar decay. And I am a happily married man who sunburns easily. This is a little longer poem about Florida, Benediction for the Savior of Orlando, which some people may have heard before. And I was invited to read at a community college in Orlando later in this year, and so I'm kind of faced with a quandary about this poem. I have a feeling that in one sense I was invited to read there because of this poem, but in the other sense, after you hear it, it would be kind of, strikes me as would be very poor of me to read it if I... when I go. Let me just say that the poem ends with two voices speaking back and forth, a prayer being uttered and a voice over the loudspeaker at a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant, kind of which I'll kind of indicate with my little hand gestures. It's nice to have a poem which you get to use hand gestures. Hello, Rich, how are you? Glad you could make it. Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. Signs and wonders. Jesus is Lord over Greater Orlando, snake-tagged in cadmium on a vine-grown cyclone fence along I-4 downtown, along I-4 southbound north of downtown, is a credo that converts the... Okay, I got to start again. It was Rich. He did it. He came in late. He got off the commuter train. He just threw me totally off. Yeah, it's okay. Benediction for the Savior of Orlando. Signs and wonders. Jesus is Lord over Greater Orlando, snake-tagged in cadmium on a vine-grown cyclone fence along I-4 southbound north of downtown is a credo that subverts the conventional wisdom that Walt Disney is the Messiah and his minions the christened stewards of this place, that the kingdom to come shall be Mickey's, that the bread of our communion will be proffered by ATM and the wine quaffed without taint of sulfites or trademark infringement, all of which is certainly true and yet too pat, too much like shooting mice in a barrel when there are nastier vermin to contest and purgatories far worse than Disney's realm of immortal simulacra suckled at the breast of Lake Buena Vista. There is, for one, Orlando itself. Orlando rightly considered, Orlando qua Orlando. Nobody anywhere could honestly propose Orlando as a fit model for human habitation, city with the character of a turnpike restroom, city with the soul of a fast food establishment, sanitized and corporatized, homogeneous and formulaic. Orlando is the holy land of the branded and franchised. Orlando is the Jerusalem of commodified delight. Orlando, Orlando, so many Orlandos I commence to feel downright Shakespearean. But here is no Rosalind to dignify our tale, no touchstone to transform its tragedy to farce. Because Orlando is the Florida I fear to conceive, Florida ordained like the antechamber to that afterworld where jackal-headed Anubis prepares his embalmer's instruments to pump our veins with tincture of liquid sunshine until we are reduced to some nebulous acquiescence. A citizenry mummified within the cambric of material satiety, within the gated stucco walls of economic segregation and the hairy stucco arms of armed response security. A people determined to rev our outboards and troll for bass in the shadow of the form glass temples to corporate profit while the fill ponds grow heavy with duckweed and algae and the golf courses burn with viridian fire through seasons of rain and seasons of drought and the metropolis spreads ever outward the bland picnic blankets of its asphalt dominion. Landscape drained of spontaneity and glee, bones boiled free of communal gristle. Is it any wonder the children of this America rise up with guns to wreak a senseless vengeance? The very children that might have saved us, the ones we had relied on to assemble in fellowship and attend to counsels of greater wisdom than those to which we have given credence. Perhaps the children were absent from school the day these lessons were offered, or perhaps the lessons have been censored from the curriculum, or there was no curriculum, or the schools had been demolished to make room for the future. A serial cataclysm of vinyl and asphalt, a republic of bananas and banana republics, where cars are the chosen and credit cards the elect, where Judge Judy balances the scales of justice, and the anthem of our freedom is sung by Chuck E. Cheese. Here I may testify with absolute conviction. Chuck E. Cheese is the monstrous embodiment of a nightmare. The bewhiskered Mephistopheles of Ring Toss, the diabolical vampire of our transcendent ideals. Every Chuck E. Cheese's erected across the mall lands of America is another nail in the coffin of human aspiration, and every hour spent in one takes 6 months off your life. No, 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 it's not a theme restaurant or family amusement center, but a vision of infernal despair enjoined in plastic flames. The clownish horror of the place is unspeakable, yet I feel that I must speak of it. For I have been to the birthday party of Emily, turning 5, the birthday party of Max, turning 8 or 9, of Max again, of David and Doris, of Myrna and Roberto. I can bear witness to its odors of chocolate milk and floor cleanser, the formica falsity of its processed cheese food pseudo-pizza, its banquet tables arrayed with pitchers of lurid orange soda and the kids in the arcade room playing air hockey and whack-a-mole and teaching one another to cheat at skee-ball to win a screel of coupons to redeem for tiny chintzy prizes, the worst sorts of craftily packaged trash, stringless army parachute guys, malformed monster finger puppets, Chinese yo-yos that self-destruct at the flip of a wrist, a rainbow-colored peep show designed to entice the youngest among us to invest their lives in a cycle of competitive consumption, and then the animatronic hoedown commences its banjo jangle, the hairy rodent orchestra churring their cymbals on stage as the gray rat man emerges from his curtain redolent of mildew, the incubus, the secret sharer, Chuck E. Cheese himself. And the baby children scream in dismay, and the larger children gag with disinterest, and the parents pay no attention at all, while employees with the fear and candy-glazed eyeballs of medium-security inmates stutter their prescripted remarks over a public address system in whose interstitial silences one may discern the voices of the lost upraised in prayer. We're having a great day at Chuck E. Cheese. Hear us, help us, grant us benison. Pick up your food at the counter, PJ. Comfort and guide us, lead us to salvation. Everyone loves family fun at Chuck E. Bestow the mercies of your blessing. Cheese, for your safety, wear shoes at all times. Upon our souls, we beseech thee. Last call for pickup, PJ. Last call, Lord of our fathers, Almighty God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. One more poem from Florida. the zebra longwing, which, as everybody knows, is the state butterfly of Florida. Does Illinois have a state butterfly? Anybody have any idea? Not many states do. I was curious how many. The upper Midwest is not really butterfly territory in such large degree as Florida. The zebra longwing. 40 years I have waited, uncomprehending, for these winter nights when the butterflies fold themselves like paper cranes to sleep in the dangling roots of the orchids boxed and hung from the live oak tree. How many there are, 6, 8, 11. When I missed the spikes and blossoms by moonlight, they stir but do not wake, antennaed and dreaming of passion flower nectar. Never before have they gifted us in like manner. Never before have they stilled their flight in our garden. Wings have borne them away from the silk of the past as surely as some merciful wind has delivered us to an anchorage of such abundant grace, Elizabeth. All my life I have searched, without knowing it, for this moment. I want to read new work. It's always exciting to say. I have a new book that I guess will be coming out maybe late next year or early 2005. And the book's called Pax Atomica. And perhaps unsurprisingly, it concerns American culture and landscape. And how it, in some large degree, concerns, I think, the kind of romance between the self and the larger society, the way in which one grows up inextricably within one's culture and then seeks to understand where one ends and where the culture begins. I'll read 3 or 4 at least poems from that, and then after that end with an even newer poem. And a lot of the poems in this book are in terza rima, a kind of loose terza rima. And many of them take rock and roll songs as a kind of touchstone, a place, a cultural marker by which the kind of archaeology by which one goes back in the past and precisely dates what one was doing by the pop culture markers that happen to be playing somewhere in the background at that moment in time. And this one's called Girl with Blue Plastic Radio. The first song I ever heard was The Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde. There was a girl at the playground with a portable radio, lying in the grass near the swing set beyond the sun-lustered aluminum slide, kicking her bare feet in the air, her painted toenails, toes the color of blueberries, rug burns, yellow pencils, Grecian urns. This would be when, 1966? No, later, 67 or 68. And no, it was not the very first song I ever heard, but the first that invaded my consciousness in that elastically joyous way music does. The first whose lyrics I tried to learn, my first communication from the gigawatt voice of the culture, popular culture, mass culture, our culture, kaboom, raw voltage embraced for the sheer thrill of getting juiced. Who wrote that song? When was it recorded and by whom? Melody lost in the database of the decades, but still playing somewhere in the mainframe cerebellums of its dandelion-chained, banana-bike-riding, Kool-Aid-addled listeners, still echoing within the flesh-and-blood mausoleums of us, me, we, them, the self-same blades of wind-sown crabgrass spoken of and to by Whitman. And who can believe it would still matter decades or centuries later in a new millennium, matter what we listened to, what we ate and watched, matter that it was rock and roll, for so we knew to call it, matter that there were hit songs, girls, TVs, fallout shelters. Who was she, her with the embroidered blue jeans and bare feet, toenails gilded with cryptic bursts of color? She is archetypal, pure form, but no less believable for that. Her chords still resonate. Her artifacts have endured so little changed as to need no archaeological translation. She was older than me, worldly and self-assured. She was, already, a figure of erotic fascination. She knew the words and sang the choruses, and I ran over from the sandbox to listen to a world she cradled in one hand, transistorized oracle, blue plastic embodiment of our neo-space-age ethos. The hulls of our Apollonian rocket ships were as yet unbarnacled, and we still found box turtles in the tall weeds and mossy grass by the little creek not yet become what it was all becoming in the wake of the yellow earth movers, that is, suburbia. Alive, vibrant, unself-consciously evolving, something new beneath the nuclear sun, something new in the acorn-scented dark. Lived there until I was 7 in a cinderblock garden apartment, my prefab haven, my little duplex ark, and the name of our subdivision was Americana Park. Which is where I grew up. I think I was prefigured to assume the mantle of a critic of the American empire. I want to read another one in that sequence, which is a little different. It's called Rock and Roll. Been a long time since I rock and rolled, Led Zeppelin says in its famous song called, quite rightly, Rock and Roll, as so many are, so far so good, but then what? Been a long time since I did the stroll, as Robert Plant would have it understood, or been a long time since the Dead Sea Scrolls. Both, in their way, are intelligible. Both possess sense-making apparatus and embay syntactical protocols. Both signify. Both are full of meaning. Both call to us across the void, hello. But their ways and means of meaning what they mean and saying what they say are as different as night from day. The first, a formulaic, stripped clean, boogie-woogie rant. The second, an implicit commentary on the historicity of the text. A not uncommon species of lit crit cant. Coy reference to the complexity of deciphering what we hear and what we read in or out of context. Like the time in Verona, we could have seen Lou Reed in the Roman amphitheater that is one of the glories of Western civilization, but Elizabeth wouldn't go because she thought I meant Lou Rawls. Two short poems from this manuscript, one of which is the broadside that the Poetry Center has produced, which is a very beautiful artifact, which they have available back there. I'm pitching the broadside, but again, I have no monetary stake in the broadside, so believe me, it's purely an endeavor on behalf of them, but it's very beautiful. And I think that the act of creating broadsides for the visiting poets is really neat. I mean, it makes it, for me as a visitor, a kind of really neat landmark to the occasion. And this is that poem. And it is called Love, Love Copyright, Love with a little copyright symbol. I'm assuming that Julian maybe ought to look into copywriting if they don't have that copyright on that yet. Love, copyright. I've got the copyright on love, honey baby. Registered patent number such and such. Don't dilly-dally with saxifrage and sassafras. Don't bother me with this and that. Don't mix the salt in my vanilla. You think a bird in the eye of the ocean of springtime knows love? Cinnamon, I'm drowning in it. Don't tell me it's cold because I'm burning with it. I've got the trademark. I've got the copyright. Cupcake, sweet molasses, sugar pie. This poem is called The Human Heart. We construct it from tin and ambergris and clay, ochre, graph paper, a funnel of ghosts, whirlpool in a downspout full of midsummer rain. It is, for all its freedom and obstinance, an artifact of human agency in its maverick intricacy, its chaos reflected in earthly circumstance, its appetites mirrored by a hungry world like the lights of the casino in the coyote's eye. Old as the odor of almonds in the hills around Solano, filigreed and chanceled with flavor of blood oranges, fashioned from moonlight, yarn, nacre, cordite, shaped and assembled valve by valve, flange by flange, and finished with the carnal fire of interstellar dust. We build the human heart and lock it in its chest and hope that what we have made can save us. And one or two more poems from this manuscript before everyone. I'm going to read a poem called Infinite Needs. And the title comes from Marshall Solins. the eminent anthropologist at the University of Chicago, from his essay, The Original Affluent Society. And here's the quote it comes from. "But then it was not until culture neared the height of its material achievements that it erected a shrine to the unattainable, infinite needs." It's in three sections. One, America's hunger takes nothing for granted. Ants hollowing fallen fruit, recasting the temple of the pomegranate. Mice in their congress of grain, squirrels in the heart of a deciduous continental democracy. Mountains scored by rivulets, granite beds, plains of salt or river clay, subduction and production and consumption driven by the master narrative of orogeny. Magma become lava in the act of eruption, as a chocolate egg ruptures its shell of golden foil in a hand that might belong to young Tom Jefferson pursuing the butterfly of his happiness, or Benjamin Franklin flying a kite, or the daydreaming machinist Henry Ford inventing the mass market, or you or me or everyone or no one. America's epic is the odyssey of appetite. Two. After Laramie, the bad scene in Motel 6, they follow the red lights of transcontinental rigs across Wyoming in thickening weather, through the Wasatch where a dozen splayed elk hit by a truck at the false lick of rock salt bleed the fast lane to ruddy ice, then skid the last exit to escape an impending whiteout in Salt Lake. In the morning, they find themselves snowblind and heartsick, and the desert is a highway slick with frost followed west to a world whose beauty admonishes their tribulations. Their final night amid the mirrored walls of the adult motel by the Oakland airport, all they can afford before her flight out at dawn. When she leaves, he wanders San Francisco with a busted Walkman and an old green sweater so full of holes, the waiter at a Chinese restaurant sews them closed and slips the talisman of a single tangled thread into his palm. He heads north, hitchhiking I-5, following the two lanes among orchards into foothills scented with almonds. Works for a while bottling cherry cider beneath Mount Shasta. Works pumping gas, watching flocks of birds circle the buttes and desolate lakes near Burns, Oregon. Eating cold hot dogs from the package, hearing the tintinnabulation of his loneliness in the chimings of a mouse leaping from hangar to empty hangar in the closet of the weed-fringed trailer. Small friend, tiny bell ringer, little comrade of the sunrise. Spring, he follows the snowmelt rivers coastward, sleeps among rose bushes bald for replanting in Portland, works cleaning floors at the aquarium, works pulling racks from the oven at Winchell's Donuts before dawn. South to Coos Bay, the lost coast, a meadow of salt hay in Albion. Works the artichoke fields, quits, moves on. Sleeps for weeks beneath a pier near Monterey, where, one night, he alters form and swims the cold Pacific as a sea lion, a transformation that will prove impossible to explain or comprehend through all the years he carries the image of the kelp forest engraved in his memory, inked gravity of its groves and alcoves, pods and tendrils, swirled hawsers emerging in dreamtime as a thread through passages of abandoned shells to the chamber of the minotaur like tarnished silver in the moonlight. So Perseus was right, then, having found himself in the maze, in the vaulted death stench of the bull, to leave the black sails billowing. There could be no return to his former life. The labyrinth would live forever within him, and he in it, waiting. Three. The universe is a fire in which all things perish. Every gem, every atom, every hyacinth is consumed by the conflagration of time. We dare not tarry in the ash fields, and we cannot halt the flames, against which our hungers shine palely, like mushrooms at the edge of a burning forest. So we walk forth into the future, consuming as we are consumed. two more poems from this book, and then a final closing poem. Capitalist poem number 55. Since it's not paginated, this manuscript is a little bit harder to locate myself in, but I hope you forgive me a minute. Capitalist poem number 55. What they mean when they say we're living in the information age is the Olympian vox populi of CNN as global witness to our local forms of carnage, the axe clash of data giants in quest of net worth, emerging markets maxing the sweet pea amperage that fuels the rise of the Cartoon Network in a realm of flesh and bone cartoons whose babble of thought balloons no longer works and a new millennium dawns, 1,000 years of Scooby-Doo, 1,000 years of oblivion. The notion that people will be watching Scooby-Doo in the canyon cities of Mars one day is something that often keeps me up at night. The final poem from this book, which is the final poem in the book, too, is called Everybody Knows John Lennon is Dead. And then I'm going to just touch on one more poem at the end. Everybody knows John Lennon is dead. Seated on the avenue, eating almond ice cream beneath the orange trees, the Andalusian heat seems at last to have lessened, or at least there is a breeze to squall the dusty citrus leaves along the cobbled alleyways as a melange of ambient music emerges from the barrio. Euro disco, Hendrix and the Beatles, flamenco guitar. We'll say now the poem is in Seville in Spain. A kid on a Vespa hops the curb to deliver a Serrano ham to the bar across the street. Joint of a pig wrapped in muslin carried cross town on his shoulder. Nice to know they still resist our microbial foibles, our fetish with sterility, though there are clearly some exotic new strains of growth in Sevilla's petri dish. You can tell how much has changed by the Germans begowned in halter tops and spandex shorts, milling in fiendish prolegidral that resembles a reticulated spider escaped from some dank cage of the Iberian Dark Age. As if every least rain droplet of the future were not equally and altogether new, alike as minted coins or the waters of the fountain before El Giralda, toward which even now the carriage horses stare in mute desire. Strange the way one's life comes to seem a historical diorama, looking back as from rocky peaks across golden valleys where regiments of moonlit sunflowers lay siege to the Alhambra. Sometimes, in the childhood of a now past century, my family would forego dinner to banquet on banana splits at the old Gifford's ice cream parlor out the parkway, with the ornate water fountain and marble tabletops, cloth napkins and fluted silver spoons and formal glassware like these, though this, however reminiscent, is not American ice cream. You can tell by the intensity of flavor, the almondness of the almond, as you can tell from the woven rubber chairs that this is not my long-gone suburbia or any American anywhere, though it could perhaps be Rome 30 years ago, when the street vendors hawked necklaces of hammered iron nails wired to leather thongs, and those clickety-clackety plastic bolas in the floodlights along the Tiber, a city of bridges and diesel fumes and casual decay like this one, though you can tell it isn't Rome by the scent of rotten citrus in the air and the muzzled shadows of Moorish arches and the wine is wrong, and though it is always childhood for somebody somewhere, it certainly isn't mine. You can tell because the boys are drawing aliens on the placemats with sugar crystal hair, still moving forward, not yet dreaming in reverse, trafficking in a social brotherhood that promises to never end. And when Strawberry Fields fades down to street noise, Jackson asks, "Which Beatle sings that one, Dad?" And Sam says, "John Lennon." And Jackson says, "Idiot, everybody knows John Lennon is dead." I've got one subsidiary pitch to make, and that's for a creative writing program in Dublin, Ireland. I'm going to be teaching this coming summer. I've got little brochures here if anyone's interested. It's a great program with Denise Duhamel, who read for the Poetry Center last year, who's my colleague at Florida International University, and with Nick Carbo, another terrific young poet who's going to be teaching at Columbia College this spring, in fact. Everybody's tied to Chicago, and it's at Trinity College Dublin. It'd be really neat. I got brochures if you want them. Finally, back to Chicago, a poem called Late Spring. a poem that I wrote last spring while teaching at the University of Chicago and while teaching a bunch of great young poets. As always happens, they teach me too. This poem has an epigram from the Chinese poet Po Chu Yi. The kingdom of perception is pure emptiness. Late spring. 1. I have faltered in my appointed duty. It is a small sacrilege, a minor heresy. The nature of the duty is close attention to the ivory and its tracery on riled brick, the buckled sidewalk, the optimistic fern, downed lilacs brown as coffee grounds, little twirled seed wings falling by the thousands from the maples in May wind, and the leaves themselves daily greener in ripening sunlight. To whom is their offering rendered, and from whom derived, these fallen things urging their bodies upon the pavement? There is a true name for them, a proper term, but what is it? 2. All day I was admonished to admire the beauty of this single peony, but only now, in late starlight, do I crush its petals to my face. Elemental silk dimmed to ash, reddening already to the brushstroke of dawn. Its fragrance is a tendril connecting my mind to the rain, a root, a tap, a tether. Casting about, lachrymose, branches of the trees at first light, flush with upthrust flowers like white candles in blackened sconces. Such is the form of the duty, but which is its officer, the world or the senses? The many languages of birds now refusing to reconcile, and clouds streaming out of the darkness like ants to the day's bound blossom. Thank you all very much. Thanks for having me. Thanks. He's back. Questions, any questions, thoughts, comments? I just have to start monologuing. Say again? Orlando? Yeah, you know, it's going to be hard. I mean, I just won't read that poem, that's all. I mean, you know, Orlando is, again, it's nothing personal. It's a corporate issue, not a personal, not a human issue. That's the issue. It's the submerging of the human beneath the corporate, which Orlando strikes me as the kind of epitome of in America. I mean, it seems to me once that Las Vegas was the epitome of that, but it seems to me now Las Vegas being so outré that Orlando is more to the point. Living in Florida, too, it's unavoidable. You thought over here? Yeah, question? Thank you. Well, I don't know. Verbal energy is. I'm really interested in the language, at the level at which it seems to me evolving and full of. I mean, I like exploring the language, for its kind of culturally evolving edges. You know, the new words that come out of economics and out of the culture and out of computers. I mean, we have such a living language, and we have a global language too. I mean, you know, the way that you know, new industries and technologies that America dominates, as that the language of American terminology gets absorbed globally. So that's interesting for me, and is one source, I think, of energy in the language, is looking around. I think it's just kind of a, you know, I don't think there's any mandate that you have a kind of high energy language to be a good poet. You can be extremely quiet, and be the quiet voice is often more, you know, profound. But it just happens to really be my voice as a writer. I mean, I couldn't write any other way. I've tried. You know, I mean, people say, wow, you're like on the Walt Whitman half of the agenda. I say, well, but I wish I could be Emily Dickinson, and I just can't. You know, I can't kind of quiet myself down long enough to find anything resembling that kind of compression and reserve. Again, yeah. Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I guess that that's kind of implicitly something I've always been doing as a poet, is exploring my, you know, my own. In other words, I don't think of myself as an autobiographical writer, although I often write autobiographically. I kind of, because I tend to write about myself, but I tend to write about myself as a kind of citizen of the empire, you know, and a kind of objectively observed, you know, person walking through late American, you know, late 20th century, of course, we're well into the 21st century. I'm not, as a poet, particularly fascinated with my own family members, but I'm interested in understanding the larger world. Again, that's just a kind of personal take. It's kind of quixotic. I don't think poetry is really ideally suited to undertake that large documentary sweep, but it happens that I really like writing poetry more than any other kind of any other form, and that's what I want to write about. And it took me a while to discover, you know, at the beginning as a poet, discover ways of accommodating that. You know, how do you? Julian mentioned in his introduction. I mean, you know, the 7-Eleven was very important to me as a beginning poet. Like, why? You know, I want to write poems about 7-Elevens, not about, you know, artworks in Florence. Because we've had, you know, 600 years of good poems written about those same artworks, and I don't feel I have anything to add to that commentary. I feel like I'm poorly situated to talk about it, but I feel like I'm ideally situated to talk about 7-Elevens. You know, so, I mean, I felt it was being true, in other words, to my kind of intellectual and historical self to comment on this culture. Yeah, Rich. Yeah, I think you do. You just hear, you know, you hear stuff in the language. Like, I just wrote down a thing they were just talking about with somebody corporate. Oh, it was Michael Eisner at Disney. They said, well, he was on a charm offensive because he's been under assault. I said, charm offensive is that's a great title for a poem. That's not necessarily a new piece of the language, but it's just a kind of, you know, very expressive little coinage that you say, that's a neat, you know, piece of language. Let's find where you go with that. And, you know, I don't know, I'll write down a phrase. Like, another one is, like, you know, the big, I don't think this phrase is used quite much anymore. They call those big category stores category killers, like Linen, Bed and Bath and Beyond. It's a category killer. It's a, you know, that's a great piece of language, too, a category. I mean, we live in an age of category killers and charm offensives, and I think that's neat. And I think identifying that, you know, that's the language that is, you know, that's the edge of the language. I mean, again, I only really speak English, American English, very well. But, other American English, we have no council protecting the language in the way that, you know, the French Academy does. And the Spanish language, as has been reported to me, is famously non-evolutionary. It resists change. So I think that, again, it's a kind of peculiarly American thing to have the language as plastic as it is. No, not very much, really. I mean, no. The whole point of the endeavor is to put in the, you know, the 1,000 hours of work to make it appear spontaneous, right? I mean, that's not everyone's goal, but I mean, there's a notion of trying to get at, you know, the feel of the consciousness, to feel like these ideas are just evolving and this language is still fluid in this narrator's consciousness. But really, no, it all comes from retrospection. I mean, you know, certain pieces of it, you know, the phrase charm offensive jumps out at you, and so that's a piece of something. But then I mean, I don't know that I'll ever use that in a poem, but I might, and it, but it would come later, and then I'd write it, and I wouldn't know what it was. And I mean, there's, you know, I'm at a place that I've written 5 books, my 6th book last year. I'm writing books over periods of a lot of years now. I mean, in other words, I'm really writing 3 or 4 books at a time. So this book, the new book coming out next year, has poems and some poems in it that are 8 or 9 years old, and some that are, you know, just from last year. And looking forward, I think I'm going to be writing a more kind of notebook-like piece that's going to take probably a lot of years to evolve. So I'm in no rush to finish anything ever, and I have a hard time considering anything finished. So I mean, occasionally you say, okay, I think that's it for that piece. You know, I think I really got everything I want to say right. Maybe there's just that 1 or 2 words, but I write, you know, you think you have to write spontaneously to yourself in your notebooks or your journals or whatever, but then I don't think the finished poem is a spontaneous piece. It's complicated, though, because, of course, you do want the sense of energy or liveness, but spontaneity is often confused for that, and I think it confuses people because they think, why can't I just sit down and write off in one draft a great finished artwork, which obviously I think anyone in any art knows is a kind of crazy notion. Yeah. I don't think so. I have written, I occasionally write kind of surrealistically. But I'm just much too controlling of a person. I don't dare let that stuff go. I have to stamp and domineer. My ego has to trample all over it first. That's kind of my, you know, I enjoy visiting the kind of, you know, subterranean areas of the brain where interesting stuff lurks, but just going with that as my finished product, I've never been comfortable with. I tend to think that, you know, people's surreal selves sound more similar than their real selves, so that one surrealist writer sounds a lot like the next, whereas that's not necessarily true of realist writers, but that's a category. I mean, that may not be true. I don't want to speak too critically. Hey, Miles. What poems go in what books? Well, it's just the last 3 books I've published have just happened to have a kind of very uniform identity to them. In other words, my first 2 books of poetry were kind of collections of poetry. They had thematic or other ties, but they were more collections of lyric poems. Then I wrote a book, Spring Comes to Chicago, which is predominantly a long 75-page poem about Bob Hope, the Bob Hope poem. So that was basically a long poem. So that was one work in and of itself. Then the next book I published was called Road Atlas, and that's all prose poems. So that was a kind of formal project, exploring prose poems. And then the last book was this book, Florida Poems. So in other words, I was writing Road Atlas and Florida Poems simultaneously, and the prose poems went in one pile, and the poems about Florida went in the other. But actually, the book that'll come out next year is the first kind of regular old book of poems I've published since American Noise. It's kind of like a sequel to American Noise, this new book. If that may mean something to 2 or 3 of you who could understand that connection point. But it's the first book of kind of lyric poems. I don't feel like I write lyric poems very often. I'm kind of like writing a fragmented personal epic poem is my vision of what I do. Not through choice, again. It's just kind of what happened. Rarely do I write a poem, like some of the poems, but, you know, like the poem that they made the broadside out of is a little lyric poem, and the poem The Human Heart is a little lyric poem. I mean, a kind of freestanding little creation out of language with a kind of tied up in a package in the way that a lyric poem is kind of supposed to work. I don't do that very well. So, and I don't even try to do it very much. Instead, I'm trying to, like, get this big, I'm trying to, you know, film this huge documentary of kind of, you know, the American culture. And I would even like to be a documentary filmmaker, except that then you'd have to have cameras and film and the lights don't work and everything, and it's such a hassle. And instead, it's just you and, you know, you and your notebook. The immediacy of writing poetry is what makes poetry the place where things live for me. You know, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. I write out of landscape. Reticulated spider. This is a very weird cathedral. The cathedral in Sevilla is huge, but it's basically just grotesque, kind of. I mean, it's a real Dark Ages cathedral, not a kind of more enlightened cathedral. Why do I write out a landscape? I don't know. That's a kind of, I remember reading Richard Hugo's book, The Triggering Town, which is a really neat book. He writes about, like, for him, what triggered, taking a train ride across the Great Plains and seeing a little town with a grain belt beer sign would just, like, that said poetry to him. And travel in all forms often speaks poetry to me. I mean, I really like to write about the places I know well, like Chicago or now Florida, the places I don't know but I pass through and I say, what's that place's identity? What's that all about? It just works for me. And again, it's that documentary kind of horizontal impulse. I have a horizontal impulse as a poet as opposed to a vertical impulse. Do we have time for one more? Thoughts about the prose poem? I didn't read any prose poems. You'll be happy to know. Prose poems are really neat. They're a way of broadening the linguistic, syntactical palette of your writing, because in a prose poem, you can just have some pieces of the poem that are just plain old chunky prose, and they don't have to be kind of digested and transformed into poetry line by line. And that can be broadening to the poem. It can also, it raises the question, though, yes, but what transforms this prose at all to poetry? Why does this piece of prose deserve any claim on the title of poetry? And that has to be done with the attention to language, and especially with the kind of structure and movement of the piece. It has to have a kind of poetic movement towards closure, development, and, has to have other features. But it's a great, I think prose poems are really great, expansive. Again, as one who has an interest in expanding lyric poetry larger so as to accommodate data and stuff that I want to throw in there, prose poems have often proven to be a neat way for me to go. But after writing a whole book of prose poems a couple years ago, I got very tired of them. I was like desperate to get back to writing in lines. They seemed really happy, nice to be back in lines. So thank you all again very much for coming. Thanks.